Ladies, let's talk. Did you know that women's peak reproductive years are between the late teens and late 20s? Some research indicates that peak fertility among American women is age 22, with an ideal first pregnancy at age 23. Well, that just ain't realistic with most people's timelines. There are a lot of reasons why you wait to start a family. That's where Ritual comes in. Their 3-in-1 fertility support was designed in partnership with an OBGYN and a fertility specialist, and it uses clinically studied ingredients and clinically studied dosages to support conception outcomes. As an OBGYN, I trust Ritual products because they are rigorously third-party tested for heavy metals, allergens, and microbes for safety during preconception and pregnancy. Their fertility support is the first 3-in-1 drink mix formulated with clinically studied ingredients to support conception outcomes. It includes myo-inositol, which helps support egg health, promotes normal ovulation cycles, and helps support healthy hormone levels. NAC provides antioxidant support and helps support ovarian health, and CoQ10 helps support follicular health and cellular energy production. Listen, I did my own research, and these ingredients really are proven to help with fertility. So bring the fertility science back to your bedroom with 3-in-1 fertility support from Ritual. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/Dr. Nicole. That's ritual.com/Dr. Nicole for 25% off. July is Fibroid Awareness Month, so today I am re-airing an episode on what happens when you have fibroids during your pregnancy and also the impact of having had fibroids removed before pregnancy. Now, if you want to connect with other folks who may have experience with having fibroids during pregnancy, or just want to connect with other women and birth workers during your pregnancy, whether you have fibroids or not, then join my free Facebook group, All About Pregnancy and Birth Inner Circle Community. There are over 1,000 folks in the group, and it's a great, supportive, no drama space. Head to Facebook, search for All About Pregnancy and Birth, and we will accept you right away. Okay, let's get into the episode on uterine fibroids and the impact they have on pregnancy.
Welcome to the All About Pregnancy and Birth podcast. If you're having a baby in the hospital, you are giving birth in a system that too often takes away power from women over what happens in their own bodies. I'm Dr. Nicole Calloway Rankins, a practicing board-certified OBGYN who's had the privilege of helping well over 1,000 babies into this world. I've been a doctor for over 20 years, and I'm here to help you take back your power, advocate for yourself, and have the beautiful pregnancy and birth that you deserve. This podcast is for educational purposes only, and it's not a substitute for medical advice. Check out the full disclaimer at drnicolerankins.com/disclaimer. Now let's get to it. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. This is episode number 103. Thank you for being here and spending some of your time with me today. So you're going to learn today about uterine fibroids in pregnancy. And I've actually gotten quite a few questions about this, more honestly than I think I would have expected. And the questions indicate that there's just a lot of unknown, uncertainty, maybe a bit of misunderstanding about fibroids in pregnancy. So in this episode, you're going to learn first a bit about fibroids outside of pregnancy, because it's important to understand that in order to understand how they impact pregnancy. So we'll just talk about what fibroids are, how common they are, some risk factors for fibroids, and then go into what happens with uterine fibroids in pregnancy, some of the symptoms that you may experience, complications that can arise, how fibroids can change the way that we manage pregnancy, and then what happens if you've had fibroids removed before your pregnancy. Now, before we get into the episode, let me do a listener shout out. This is to The Colors of the Harder Style. And the title of the podcast is, the title of the review is My Favorite Podcast. And the review says, I am currently 30 weeks pregnant and found this podcast when I was about 9 weeks along. I have made my way through almost every episode now, and I just love Dr. Rankins. She has a very unique and unbiased way of delivering information, and her voice is so soothing. My husband and I just started her online birth course as well, and it is just as amazing as the podcast. I am so grateful I found this pod. It has truly been a highlight in this journey. Well, thank you. Thank you for that really, really lovely review. I so appreciate you inviting me to be along on your pregnancy journey, and I'm glad that you found the podcast helpful. All right, so let's get into the episode and talk about uterine fibroids. So, fibroids are non-cancerous tumors that come from the smooth muscle cells, the muscle cell layer of the uterus. The uterus has three layers. The innermost layer is the endometrium. That is the layer that sheds during a menstrual period. Then the thick or middle layer, the muscle layer, is the myometrium. That is where fibroids develop from smooth muscle cells in the myometrium. And then the outermost layer of the uterus is the serosal layer, and that's kind of a thin, filmy layer that overlays the uterus. Now, fibroids are often or sometimes referred to as myomas, and the medical term is leiomyoma, but I'm just going to say fibroids during the episode. Fibroids happen almost exclusively in reproductive age women. Like, you're not going to see them in children. You also don't see new fibroids develop after menopause. You may see them in younger women very, 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 very rarely in adolescence, but mostly it's reproductive age women. And outside of pregnancy, if they cause symptoms, and keep in mind that not all fibroids cause symptoms. There are plenty of people who have uterine fibroids and they don't bother the person at all. They don't cause any symptoms. But if you do have symptoms, those symptoms will typically be abnormal uterine bleeding, and that's typically going to be heavy menstrual periods. Sometimes the periods are also irregular, but heavy bleeding. And then also symptoms just from the size of the fibroids being there. And typically that can manifest as pelvic pain or pelvic pressure. Now, the way that we describe fibroids is by their location within the uterus. So submucosal fibroids, those are fibroids that are in the muscle layer, but they're closest to the endometrium, to the lining of the uterine cavity. And we classify these roughly as protruding into the uterine cavity, less than 50%, greater than 50%. So these, again, are ones that are closest to the endometrium or the uterine cavity. Then intramural fibroids are just mostly in the wall, in that muscle layer of the uterus. And then subserosal fibroids are fibroids that are closer to the serosal side of the uterus, so more on the outside of the uterus. They can sometimes be what's called pedunculated, meaning that they are hanging off of a stalk, okay? So again, the fibroids are either closer to the endometrium, so protruding into the endometrial layer, that's submucosal, then intramural in the wall, and then subserosal on the outermost part, and they can be pedunculated. Oh, there's also rarely cervical fibroids, where you have fibroids in the cervix, the uterine cervix. That's really rare, but that is a possibility as well. I will have a couple of images in the show notes page of the website. If you want to go take a peek and get a better idea of exactly what I'm talking about, it can be easier to see visually. And the show notes page is going to be drnicolerankins.com/episode103. And episode is all spelled out. So drnicolerankins.com/episode103. All right. How common are fibroids? Well, fibroids are actually the most common pelvic tumors in women. It's a little bit hard to know exactly how common they are because studies are always done in people who have symptoms, or they're done when we look at the uterus after a hysterectomy. A hysterectomy is a surgery to remove the uterus, and that's how we look at how often fibroids occur sometimes. So we don't necessarily capture people who are walking around and have fibroids but don't have any symptoms, because in that case, we wouldn't be looking for fibroids. Now, with that being said, we do have some data about fibroids, and it varies, but on the low end, they occur as low as 7% in white women, around in 25% of black women. And I'll talk about those racial and ethnic differences more in just a minute. And then on the high end, studies have shown that fibroids occur as high as 43% in white women and 59% of black women. Okay. So in general, they are pretty common. And the prevalence of fibroids increases as women get older. So you're going to find that they're more frequent in women who've, who are older. So in their 30s or 40s. The good news is they do actually shrink after menopause, or they don't grow after menopause. They're responsive to hormones. So again, they're only happening in reproductive age women, but they increase as we get older. And then after menopause, they're not a problem anymore. So what are some risk factors for fibroids? One of the biggest risk factors that we know of is race. Black women have a 2 to 3-fold greater risk of fibroids than white women. We do not exactly know why this is the case. It's been hypothesized that there are differences in genetic factors or diet or lifestyle, stress. Also environmental exposures between black and white women that contribute to this disparity. But again, we don't know 100% why. There is a study underway called the Study of Environment, Lifestyle, and Fibroids. It's in the Detroit area, I believe. It's enrolled about 1,500, 1,600 black women in order to understand risk factors for fibroids within black women. So hopefully we'll have more data as studies come out, but there is definitely a big disparity and difference there. There are also differences in the natural history of fibroids by race. Most white women with symptomatic fibroids are in their 30s or 40s. However, black women typically develop symptoms on average 4 to 6 years younger, and they may even have significant issues with fibroids in their 20s. It also appears that fibroids grow at a slower rate after age 45 years in white women, but not in black women. And again, we don't necessarily understand those differences, but we are working to try to understand those differences.
In my family, we prioritize sitting down and having dinner together every single night. But finding the time to plan meals, do the shopping, and cook from scratch can feel overwhelming. That is where Gobble comes in. Gobble is a meal kit delivery service where each week you can choose from their rotating menu of over 18 gourmet meals. You can mix and match from classic recipes, lean and clean recipes, and vegetarian options, and Gobble will deliver them right to your door. We recently had a Gobble meal of Baja-style fish tacos with green goddess cabbage slaw and spiced black beans. Hear me when I say it was delicious, and that's because Gobble menus are designed by professional chefs. You'll experience a huge range of global flavors and fun gourmet ingredients that make you feel like a pro chef without making a single trip to the store. The meal was super easy to come together because most of their meals only take about 20 minutes. And did I mention how good the chocolate chip cookies were for dessert? See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering my listeners a fantastic limited time deal. Get $120 off across 4 boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Go to gobble.com/Dr. Nicole. That's GOBBLE.com/Dr. Nicole today. This offer is not available on their home site, so don't miss out.
So let's talk about some things that influence fibroids developing. And I'm just going to kind of go through a laundry list of things. So one thing that influences fibroids is if you have one or more pregnancies that goes beyond 20 weeks, that will actually decrease the chance of having fibroids. Again, we don't know why that happens, but having a pregnancy that goes beyond 20 weeks will decrease the chances of fibroids happening. On the flip side, early period, so you're starting your period early at less than 10 years old in particular. That sounds crazy young, but starting your period early is associated with an increased risk of developing fibroids. And that may be because you have a longer reproductive lifespan because your periods are the start of technically, you know, when you can get pregnant. So that may be part of it. And it's also thought that this may be part of the reason why fibroids are more common in Black patients, because Black women typically have their periods earlier than white women. Hormones actually don't seem to make fibroids worse. You would think that maybe it would because, you know, they're more active in the reproductive age years when hormones are active, but it doesn't appear that using particularly standard or lower dose oral contraceptive pills, birth control pills, they don't tend to cause fibroids to grow. Therefore, birth control pills may be useful, or they may at least, you don't have to stop them if you do note that you have fibroids. There is one study that showed, and this is the Nurses Health study, that showed that using birth control pills did increase the risk of fibroids if you started using birth control pills as a teenager. But really, that's just one study. Overall, birth control pills don't seem to make fibroids get worse. Also, long acting, what's called progestin only contraception, so like Depo Provera, may actually protect against the development of fibroids. Also, progestin only birth control pills like the progestin intrauterine device, the Mirena or Kylena, have shown that they can actually decrease fibroids in size by just a little bit, not a lot. But contraception with only just progestin, and I should back up and say birth control pills typically have both estrogen and progestin, so two hormones in them, whereas progestin-only methods like Depo Provera or the Mirena IUD only have progestin in them. Those progestin ones may decrease the size of fibroids. Okay, some other things that may influence fibroids. There is a relationship shown between fibroids and increasing weight. However, it varies by study, so that is not a very, very strong association, but that association is there. There are also some differences in fibroid development related to diet. It has been shown that significant consumption of red meat or also ham is associated with an increased risk of fibroids, anywhere from a 1.3 to 1.7 increased risk of fibroids, whereas consumption of green vegetables and fruit, especially citrus fruit like oranges, can decrease the risk of fibroids. And I will say that I have seen a couple of cases where people have had a dramatic difference or decrease in their sizes, in the size of their fibroids based on changing their diet, particularly going vegetarian or even vegan, that has made a difference. Again, that's just my anecdotal experience, not proven by studies that changing your diet will make the fibroids go away. But studies do show that if you consume more vegetables and fruit, you decrease the risk of fibroids. Also, consuming vitamin A will decrease the risk of fibroids. You can find vitamin, and it has to be vitamin A, particularly from animal sources. So like salmon, tuna, or cheeses can decrease the risk of fibroids. And there's also increasing evidence that vitamin D deficiency can increase the risk of fibroids. That's also another reason why it's thought that Black people have an increased risk, because we have a higher risk of having low vitamin D. Caffeine is not a real strong risk factor for fibroids. Alcohol, however, is a risk factor for fibroids, especially beer. That does appear to increase the risk of developing fibroids. And then oddly enough, smoking decreases the risk of having fibroids. Obviously, that is not a reason to smoke, but smoking does decrease the risk of fibroids. There's also a genetic component where you may often see that fibroids run in families, whether it's between mothers and daughters or sisters. There's definitely some genetic predisposition as well. And then finally, having trouble with blood pressure, hypertension will also increase the risk of fibroid development. Okay, so let's talk about fibroids in pregnancy. So again, it's a little bit difficult to tell exactly how common they are in pregnancy. Although we do ultrasounds typically in pregnancy, especially if they're small fibroids, we may not see them. But roughly, fibroids affect anywhere from 2 to 10% of pregnancies. The prevalence of fibroids is going to increase as moms age increase. And just like outside of pregnancy, it's higher in Black women than in white women or Hispanic women. So what happens with the course of fibroids during pregnancy? We know that there are a lot of hormones in pregnancy. We know that fibroids are influenced by hormones because they happen in reproductive age women. Also, we know that the uterus is growing. So how does that impact fibroids? And then there's also a tremendous amount of increased blood flow to the uterus during pregnancy. So how does that impact fibroids as well? Well, the body of evidence suggests that fibroids actually will remain stable for most folks across pregnancy. So roughly half of cases, fibroids will stay the same. They won't get any bigger. They won't get any smaller. They will stay the same during pregnancy. And then in the other 40% or so, about half of those will increase in size and the rest will decrease in size. There's not a good hard and fast way to predict which ones will do which, but we do have some factors that may give us some clues. For example, larger fibroids and those that are greater than 5 centimeters. 5 centimeters is roughly about 2 inches. An inch is 2.5 centimeters. So 5 centimeters is roughly about 2 inches. So fibroids that are larger than that are more likely to grow, whereas smaller fibroids are more likely to remain stable in size. And even with fibroids that do increase, they don't increase by a ton. Very few increase by more than 25%. So they're not like growing tremendously during pregnancy. Also, they don't grow in a linear fashion. So it's not like they grow a little bit each week, a little bit each week. What we see is that they typically increase in size. The most growth occurs in the first trimester, with little growth occurring during the second and third trimester. So that can be reassuring that if you have fibroids that most likely they're going to, or you have a 50-50 shot that they're going to, or more, that they're going to stay stable or get smaller. And even if they do increase, they don't increase by a ton. And all of that growth is typically going to happen in the first trimester. And then in the postpartum period, actually almost 90% of women with fibroids, if they were detected in the first trimester, most women postpartum will have regression. They'll get smaller when you look at them 3 to 6 months postpartum. So that's also reassuring news. And that kind of goes along with what I said earlier, that if you have children, then it can decrease your risk of fibroids. About 10% though, those other 10% will have a decrease. But again, 90% postpartum, they will get smaller. All right, what are the symptoms of fibroids as they relate to pregnancy? Well, the good news is that usually they are completely asymptomatic and most people do not have issues with their fibroids during pregnancy. Now, if you do have symptoms, the symptoms are typically going to be pain, pelvic pressure, and that's very similar to outside of pregnancy, and then rarely vaginal bleeding. The most common symptom by far is pain, and the frequency of pain is going to increase with the increasing size of the fibroids. And again, that makes sense. When you have this bigger thing that's there, it's going to cause some discomfort, particularly if it's really big, say 7 to 10 centimeters, then it's going to potentially cause some discomfort. And most patients only have a localized pain, like where the fibroid is. Sometimes you may have fever with it. Sometimes you may have nausea or vomiting. That's not very common, but most of the time, the most common symptom is pain, and it's going to be pain right where the fibroid is. Now, that pain typically presents, it's going to happen in the first trimester or in the early second trimester, which corresponds to that period of most rapid growth. It can, however, happen at any point in pregnancy. I know I had a friend who had issues with fibroids in the third trimester of her pregnancy. I've seen it a couple times where folks have issues later on. It's not something that happens very commonly, but it can happen at any point in pregnancy. It's more likely to happen in the first trimester or early second trimester. But again, sometimes that pain can happen at any point in the pregnancy. And that pain typically comes from something called degeneration of the fibroid. So what happens is that if the fibroid grows in size, particularly if it grows faster than the blood supply to the fibroid, that leads to a circumstance where the fibroid is actually not getting enough blood to keep up with the growth, and that causes the fibroid to die, something called necrosis, and that can be painful. So that is the most often reason why pain happens. It's related to this degeneration. Now, rarely there can be issues with something called torsion, where fibroids twist on themselves. That's only for pedunculated fibroids, those ones that can be hanging off of a stalk. And that's much less common in pregnancy. Most often, it's going to be pain from the fibroid degenerating. Now, let's go through some of those other complications and things that can potentially happen during pregnancy related to fibroids. And I'm going to go through the things that are most strongly associated, and then to the end of the list, things that are least associated with fibroids. I just talked about degeneration. That's the most common thing that we know. Miscarriage can also happen in patients with fibroids. For those submucosal fibroids, and submucosal fibroids, again, are the ones that are closest to the endometrium, the inner layer of the uterus. And if that fibroid is there, particularly if it's a bigger fibroid, and the placenta implants near that or around that, it can affect implantation. It can affect the ability of the placenta to establish a normal blood flow. So that can potentially increase the risk for miscarriage with those submucosal fibroids. We definitely don't see that same sort of effect with intramural fibroids, those fibroids that are in the wall of the uterus, and the pedunculated fibroids are the ones that are furthest away from the endometrium, the subserosal fibroids. They don't particularly cause any issues with miscarriage. The risk is with those submucosal fibroids. And the more submucosal fibroids you have, the higher the risk. And that makes sense because, again, there's going to be areas where it may be difficult for the placenta to implant properly because the fibroids are distorting the normal anatomy. There's also a little bit of an increased risk of preterm labor and preterm birth in pregnancies where uterine fibroids are an issue. The risk is going to increase with having multiple fibroids, or if the placenta is near the fibroid. Also, if the fibroid is larger, okay? And again, all of these things make sense. If you have this fibroid, this thing that's there, this tumor, and it's interfering with the placenta, and the bigger it is, the more likely it is to take up space, then that's going to increase the risk of things happening. It can similarly increase the risk of bleeding during pregnancy, as well as something called placenta abruption. Placenta abruption is when the placenta separates away from the wall of the uterus prematurely. So the placenta is not supposed to separate away from the wall of the uterus until the baby is delivered, because being connected to the uterine wall is how it connects to mom's blood flow and does the oxygen exchange and exchanges nutrients and all of those things like that. So the placenta has to stay firmly attached to the uterus until after the baby is born. Placenta abruption is when that process happens before the baby is born, it can be quite dangerous in certain circumstances. And there is a slightly increased risk of placenta abruption with fibroids. Again, it's going to be related to the location of the fibroid and where that is in relation to the placenta in order to determine whether or not that is a big risk. If the fibroid is near where the placenta is, then that's going to increase the chances of placenta abruption. And I'm feeling like I'm sounding like a broken record at this point, but also if the fibroid is bigger, then that is going to increase the risk of abruption as well.
Healthcare has a history of blaming weight as some type of moral failing on the patient. Well, you deserve a different and better approach, and that's what you'll get with Mochi. Mochi is a telehealth platform that connects patients seeking medication-based weight loss treatment with board-certified doctors and dietitians to help them determine the best treatment options to accomplish weight loss. Their program is completely virtual, meaning you can access their services anywhere in the United States. The folks at Mochi are dedicated to providing holistic, patient-centered care that prioritizes overall well-being. Their goal is transforming how weight management is approached. They listen, and their mission is to make their patients feel heard and understood. They work alongside their patients towards their health goals without shame or blame. They aim to make comprehensive obesity care affordable and accessible for everyone, regardless of insurance coverage. At Mochi, they believe in a weight management medicine program that's personalized to you. Science-backed medications, including GLP-1s like Ozempic, Mounjaro, and Zepbound, are just one tool in their toolbox. They also connect you with professionals to discuss other evidence-based weight loss strategies like licensed registered dietitians and MDs who are board certified in obesity medicine. Get started today at joinmochi.com and you can use the code Dr. Nicole to receive $40 off.
So another thing that may happen with fibroids, and I should say, let me back up. Most women with fibroids, I don't think I said this, most women with fibroids actually have no complications during pregnancy related to the fibroids. I should have led with that. That should have started with that first. Most pregnant women do not have any complications during their pregnancy or birth related to fibroids. Okay. So let me say that for sure. But I do want to make you aware of the possible things that can happen. So let's continue to go through that list. The next one is malpresentation, meaning that the baby presents in a presentation other than the head down. And that is going to happen if a large fibroid distorts the shape of the uterine cavity and makes it so that the baby settles in a position and can't get in a position that's head down. That is going to be related to larger fibroids, and particularly over 10 centimeters. So those really big fibroids will make it hard for the baby to turn inside the uterus. So malpresentation is a possibility as well. Dysfunctional labor is also a possibility. Fibroids are in that muscle layer of the uterus. And if those muscles have to work around this fibroid, this tumor that's there, particularly if it's large, then it may decrease the force of contractions. Contractions happen in that muscle layer of the uterus. So it may make it difficult for the uterus to kind of have that nice coordinated contraction or spread that contraction all through that muscle layer. And if so, then that potentially may lead to a dysfunctional labor pattern where the contractions aren't as strong as we'd like, or they're not as regular as we'd like because the uterus can't quite get the contractions coordinated around the fibroids. And then finally, fibroids are associated with a slightly increased risk of cesarean birth, especially if the fibroids are located in the lower part of the uterus. And part of it is related to malpresentation, meaning the baby can't get in the right position. Part of it may be related to dysfunctional labor. Some of it may be related to literal obstruction of the baby coming out. If the fibroid is in the way of the baby coming through the vagina, then that's going to increase the risk of cesarean as well. Part of it may be related to the increased risk of placenta abruption. It's hard to determine like which one of those factors is the most, most strongly associated, I should say, but all of those things together can increase the risk of cesarean birth. Fibroids can also increase the risk of postpartum hemorrhage, a slightly increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage with fibroids, especially if fibroids are larger, especially if fibroids are near the placenta, and also if the delivery is by cesarean birth. Now, I know I just laid out a lot of like potential difficult things, but again, let me reiterate that most women with fibroids do not have any significant problems or issues or complications during pregnancy or birth. The most common thing that I see for sure is pain. If something is going to happen, it's going to be pain from a degenerating fibroid. And I'll talk a minute about how we manage that. But most people do not have any issues related to fibroids. Now, I do want to take a moment and mention some things that are not associated with fibroids. So some things that you don't have to worry about an increased risk of. And that's preterm pre-labor rupture of membrane. So PPROM, preterm pre-labor rupture of membranes. It doesn't increase your risk of your water breaking early. It doesn't increase your risk of placenta previa, which is where the placenta is overlying the opening to the cervix. So fibroids do not increase the risk of placenta previa. Fibroids do not increase the risk of growth restriction, or they don't interfere with the baby growing well. So that is good to know. Also do not increase the risk of stillbirth. Also another good thing to know, and don't increase the risk of preeclampsia. So although fibroids do have some things that they're associated with, there are some things that are definitely not increased with fibroids. So that's good news too. So let's end with how we manage fibroids during pregnancy. All right. So one thing to talk about is it possible or is it appropriate rather, should I say, to have fibroids removed before pregnancy? All right. In order to reduce the risk of any complications or issues happening. And that decision is really made on an individual basis. It depends on a lot of factors. It depends on your age. It depends on your past pregnancy history. It depends on the severity of your symptoms. It depends on the size, the location of the fibroid. So I cannot give a cut and dried response about you should have it removed or you shouldn't have it removed. It's really an individual approach, but that is something to consider. If you know you have fibroids, then you may want to talk about whether it's worthwhile or appropriate or beneficial to have them removed prior to pregnancy. Now, as far as how we manage things that may pop up related to fibroids, as I said multiple times, the most common thing is going to be pain. Very rarely, pregnant people may require hospitalization for pain management related to fibroids. When that degeneration happens and that necrosis is tissue dying, and that is perceived as a painful process. So typically we start with Tylenol. We don't have a whole lot of pain management options available, other than Tylenol. And then, we can use NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So that's Motrin. The generic is ibuprofen. Also Aleve is in the NSAID family, but we can only use those for a short course, less than 48 hours or around 48 hours or ideally 48 hours, I should say, because they have some effects on pregnancy. They can, cause oligohydramnios where the fluid is low. They can cause some issues in the baby's heart if used for a long period of time. So we really want to avoid NSAIDs for longer than 48 hours if we have to. If for some reason we have to do it longer than that, then typically we do weekly ultrasounds to check on the baby. But we use Tylenol in combination with NSAIDs for a short period of time, because usually that degeneration is not like, it's not going to happen like over like weeks and weeks and weeks. It's typically a short term thing that happens over a few days. And once we get you over that hump, then things are typically okay. So it's a short term thing that happens, and that short course of NSAIDs works really well. Now, if the Tylenol and the NSAIDs aren't working, then we can certainly add opioid medications if need be for managing pain. We do have to be careful about using opioids because longer opioid use increases the risk of opioid dependence, but we can certainly use opioids if need be. And that may be Percocet. Well, Percocet is a combination of oxycodone, which is the opioid, and Tylenol, but that's the most common one that we use. We can use those opioid medications if needed. And we can also repeat the medicines if needed. So for example, if it, 18 weeks, you have a bout of pain because of the fibroid, and for some reason it pops back up again at 25 weeks, then we can repeat a course of the NSAID medications again, a short course of the opioids again, if need be. So it can be repeated if that's necessary. Now, the other option for treatment of fibroids is procedures or surgeries. And actually, let me back up for a second and say that in general, fibroids are treated either by hormones or medications that indirectly affect hormones. So either we try birth control pills, progestins, or something called, it's like big classes of medicines that can affect your brain, send you into menopause, so to speak, that affect hormones. But none of these can be used in pregnancy. So we can't use those hormones. We can't use medicines that throw you into menopause in pregnancy. So our only option really are those pain management medications. And then the other option for treatment of fibroids outside of pregnancy is procedures or surgeries, where we block blood flow to just the fibroid itself as best we can. We use something called high frequency ultrasound to basically make the fibroid die, essentially removing the fibroid itself, and then hysterectomy. And as you can imagine, all of those things are going to impact a developing pregnancy. If you're blocking the blood flow, trying to the fibroid, but end up blocking the blood flow to the uterus, that's going to cut off the blood supply to the baby. You can't use like high frequency ultrasound in order to cause a fibroid to die without that ultrasound high frequency, different than regular ultrasound. How that ultrasound is going to affect a baby. If you're removing the fibroid, you're cutting the uterus open, then that's going to potentially disrupt the pregnancy. And obviously you can't do a hysterectomy. So I say all that to say is that there aren't a lot of options available for treatment of fibroids in pregnancy. I had someone message me and she sounded so desperate. I felt really bad. My heart went out to her because she was just perplexed that there wasn't a lot that could be done in order to manage the discomfort that she was having from this large fibroid. And, she's like, I've surged and I've had my doula search. And, it was hard to say, you don't see anything because there's nothing there. Unfortunately, really the biggest thing that we have is pain control with medication and then, addressing the fibroid with surgery afterwards. Now, there are some rare circumstances where a myomectomy is just removing just the fibroid, where that may happen during the pregnancy. I have never in my 15 years of practicing seen this happen because there is a big potential for bleeding. There's a big potential for miscarriage, for preterm delivery, for uterine rupture where the uterus opens up. So I have never seen a myomectomy done during pregnancy, because it is definitely, definitely very risky. But if there is a circumstance where there's no other way to fix the problem or the pain, then that may be an option as well. I think one place where it may be an option for sure is if you have a pedunculated one that's hanging off of a stalk and that is causing a lot of pain or discomfort, or from necrosis, or is causing some sort of obstruction or in the way with things, then that may be something to consider during pregnancy. But again, in general, doing a myomectomy during pregnancy is very risky. And there's also a lot of bleeding during a myomectomy outside of pregnancy, and certainly during pregnancy where the blood flow to the uterus is increased by a tremendous amount. So hysterectomy is possible as well. So again, we avoid myomectomy unless we absolutely have to. Now, just to wrap up, as far as the route of delivery, Most women with fibroids will have a successful vaginal birth. Okay, so let me say that again. Most women with fibroids will have a successful vaginal birth. So you should definitely be offered the opportunity to have a fibroid. Indeed, we actually prefer to avoid a cesarean birth if we can with fibroids, because depending on the location, bleeding can be quite significant. And if you have to go through a fibroid to get through the baby, like cut through a fibroid to get through the baby, that can definitely increase the risk of hemorrhage. So we would prefer a vaginal birth for sure in someone who has fibroids. We occasionally may plan a cesarean birth if the fibroid is in a place where we know it's going to obstruct labor, and then we're going to plan it as best we can to have blood products available, have support staff available, all of those things available. But in general, we definitely want to try for a vaginal birth, and most women will have a vaginal birth. Now, if you do end up needing a cesarean, please know that most of the time things go just fine, and it's not an issue and not any problem. Sometimes if fibroids are right in the way of where we're cutting, then we have to be creative about where we cut on the uterus in order to get the baby out. But even the cesarean birth tends to go fine without any issues. We just have to be prepared, have blood products available just in case, have help available just in case. A really common question is, why not just remove the fibroid at the time of the cesarean since you're already in there? But again, removing fibroids even outside of pregnancy can cause a lot of bleeding. Definitely in pregnancy can cause even more bleeding because of the increased uterine blood flow to the uterus. So we do not remove fibroids at the time of cesarean unless we absolutely, absolutely have to. And remember that most often they're going to decrease in size after pregnancy anyway. And I said that was the final thing, but actually there's one more thing. What about if you've had a fibroid removed prior to pregnancy? How does that affect your route of delivery? Well, it really is individualized, based on what type of surgery you had in order to remove the fibroid. The issue is that essentially if we have to cut through a lot of the uterus and remove several fibroids and then put all of that back together, that the uterus is not going to be as strong as it was before all of that happened. And when the uterus is weaker, similar to in the situation of having had a multiple cesarean births before, for instance, or a classical cesarean incision before, then, and that's when the uterine incision is up and down on the uterus, whereas a low transverse incision, the incision is crosswise on the uterus. So if you had like a lot of surgery on your uterus before to remove fibroids and it's not as strong, that increases the risk of uterine rupture, which can be catastrophic. It can be dangerous for baby, including up to brain problems or death. It can also increase bleeding and risk for mom. So we very often, if you've had extensive fibroid removal for sure, will recommend a cesarean birth before you go into labor, definitely before 39 weeks, sometimes as early as between 36 and 37 weeks, depending on the extent of the surgery, because ideally we want to do it in a very planned and controlled circumstance and avoid that risk of uterine rupture. So it's really going to depend on your individual circumstance and what type of procedure you had in order to know whether or not you need a cesarean birth, whether that's the safest thing for you if you've had fibroids removed. It's typically going to be the case if you've had multiple fibroids removed, or if you've had really large fibroids removed that were in the wall of the uterus. But again, it's going to be individualized. And I honestly think we tend to err on the side of caution and more frequently suggest a cesarean birth if there are a lot of fibroids removed. Now, if you had just one removed hysteroscopically, meaning like through your uterus, it was smaller, it was just on the inside of the cavity, then that may not happen. But for those bigger fibroids, more extensive surgery, then yes, most likely the safest thing is a cesarean birth. Ooh, okay, that was a lot. So just to recap, fibroids are common, especially in Black women. Most often, fibroids do not cause problems in pregnancy, but if they do, the most likely thing is going to be pain, and that can be effectively treated. We don't have a lot of options, though, to treat fibroids in pregnancy. So if you know that you have fibroids before you get pregnant, it's worthwhile to talk to your doctor about how your fibroids may affect your pregnancy. It really is individualized, and it may be recommended that you have them removed prior to pregnancy. So do have that chat if you know that you have fibroids. But again, most women with fibroids do not have any problems with pregnancy. Also, most women with fibroids have a vaginal birth and know that those fibroids are typically going to get smaller postpartum. So there you have it. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast in Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to me right now, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon even has podcasts these days. And I would really love it if you left that honest review in Apple Podcasts in particular. It helps the show to grow. It helps other women to find the show. And I do shout outs from those reviews as well. Also, be sure to check out the birth preparation course. I would be so thrilled to have you there and in our lovely online private community, all the support with the other pregnant mamas, with Keisha, the community manager, who's a doula, with me. You can check out all the details of the course at drnicolerankins.com/enroll, and that new version of the course, completely updated with new images, with me, with more content, is coming out next week. So that is it for this episode. Do come on back next week. And until then, I wish you a beautiful pregnancy and birth.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.